Podcasts on WLRN are funded in part by Make-A-Wish Southern Florida, whose own podcast, World of Wishes, features inspiring, uplifting, and memorable stories from Wish kids, their families, medical professionals, and more. You can listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
From WLRN Public Media in Miami and Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Hudson. This is After Hurricane Irma. Thanks for listening. The storm, while record-breaking in many ways, did not break the string of years two major Florida cities have escaped a direct hit. Miami was last a target for a storm in 1926. For Tampa, it was 1921. Each had just over 100,000 residents back then. Today, both cities are major population centers in the Southeast, economic drivers for the Florida economy, hosting global ports, military installations, and Fortune 500 business centers. They're also consistently listed together as cities with the most at risk to hurricanes and rising water. Miami and Tampa were spared the worst of Irma, spared the worst of this hurricane, but fate and the weather forecast are no guarantees in the future. Tomas Regalado is the mayor of the city of Miami. He's with us in our studios at WLRN in Miami. Mayor Regalado, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Tom.
Tampa Mayor Bob Buckhorn is with us from our partner station WUSF in Tampa. Mayor Buckhorn, nice to speak with you. Thanks for your time today.
Good morning. Good morning, Alcalde.
Yes, my friend. Good morning. I miss you.
I miss you too.
Mayor Regalado, let's start with Miami. You experienced the storm before Mayor Buckhorn. What kind of damage did the city suffer?
Well, you know, we thought that we were lucky because we didn't get a direct hit. And that was scary. And I tell you, Tom and Bob, with all what he did to prepare, no one is prepared for a Cat 5 or a Cat 4 hurricane. However, we did had more damages than we were told and that we expected.
Where was the damage concentrated in the city of Miami?
Well, the damage was, first of all, the marinas. The marinas took a direct hit. We had damage also in Brickell because of the storm surge.
That's
we
the have, fiscal, financial area of Miami.
Exactly. We had a lot of damage in the Grove because of the storm surge. But most of the damage is of the infrastructure. We didn't have buildings that collapsed. We had a lot of damage of the infrastructure because thousands of trees were uprooted. Mm-hmm. And they took part of the street. They took sidewalks, curbs, even sewer lines. So we are on that process. We also had a loss of, I think, and we don't know yet, of millions and billions of dollars in the economy because it's been now almost a week, and Miami was with 89% without power. Yeah. Now we are back to 19% without power, and we feel that by tomorrow, Tuesday, the whole city of Miami will be back.
There's the lost productivity function of not only the preparation up to the storm, but then, of course, a week here after, a lot of folks still are not able to go to work or have work to go to because of the damage. Mayor Buckhorn, how about Tampa? What's the damage concentrated in the Tampa area?
Well, it's largely debris removal. Most, if not all, of the power, certainly in Hillsborough County, has been restored. There are a few outlying areas like Highlands County that has significant power outages. But I will tell you that it was a topsy-turvy week for us. After fully expecting to deploy to South Florida to help our friends down there, including my friend Mayor Regalado, the storm turned our way. And when we were watching what was going on in Naples, fully anticipating that we would be next with a storm of that velocity, only to see it veer off and miss us by 30, 40 miles. The damage was relatively minimal by comparison to what we were anticipating.
Mayor Buckhorn, storm when surge, you looked at that forecast, what were the priorities for you on really Friday and Saturday? Those were the days that Tampa looked to be squarely in the sights of Irma.
We did indeed. And for us, it was all about deploying our assets, making sure we had everything ready, fully anticipating that we were going to get hit, unlike we have ever been hit before. The storm surge was the major concern for us. We knew we could withstand the wind. We knew there would be trees toppled. There would be power outages. But it was the storm surge that really scared us. And as we saw in Miami, That storm surge is really in these storms what takes people's lives and damages the most property. We were lucky. We had very, very little storm surge. By every measure, Tampa escaped this one relatively unscathed by comparisons to our friends in the Keys or in Fort Myers and Naples area.
Mayor Regalado, the city of Miami, you said no one is prepared for a Category 4 or 5. 10 days ago, that's what it looked like. Not only the city of Miami, but the city of Tampa and a good chunk of the peninsula of Florida may experience with Irma. What were the preparations that the city of Miami did this time that perhaps were unique from previous storm experiences?
Well, first of all, Tom, what we did is that, for instance, 5 days before the storm, we contracted with FEMA-approved private hauling companies in Georgia and in South Carolina, with a caveat that their trucks will be here 12 to 18 hours after the storm. So we got those two FEMA-approved. Those two FEMA-approved contractors were told to hire subcontractors here in South Florida. We also hire an audit company because FEMA, as Mayor Tampa knows, and you, doesn't pay if we don't go by the protocol. So we have an audit company that follows the caravans of trucks that are picking up. We also, on Friday, I signed a declaration of emergency. It's a tool, a legal tool for the city of Miami. Even though the president and the governor had done it, the city of Miami, because it's a chartered city, had to do something. So I signed a declaration of emergency that gave us the power to establish a curfew, because we did had and expected some looting because of no power.
Right.
And we did had some looting here in the city of Miami. We caught 18 people, six of them were actually looting stores. We also contracted, Tom and Mayor, 5 days before the storm, 10 tractor trailers of ice, because we figured that we would need that.
Yeah.
And those tractor trailers were here on Monday night.
Talking about preparing for the debris pickup, preparing for the demand for ice in Miami. Mayor Buckhorn, did you take similar measures in Tampa?
We did, and everything that Mayor Regalado said was incorporated into our plan as well, including contracting for additional fuel with companies that were – Tampa was the priority, the only priority.
Hmm.
One of the challenges that all of us had, though, is normally in storms like this, you can stage fuel, you can stage ice, you can stage food, you can stage debris removal on one side of the state or other, the side that is not affected by the storm.
Right.
This storm was so massive and so all-consuming that a lot of these entities had to stage Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina before they could come into Florida, because every part of our state was touched by this. But yes, we have learned from all of the natural disasters that this country has experienced, whether it's New Orleans, whether it's Houston, and we incorporate those success stories into our plan and try to avoid making the mistakes that were made in those other cities.
Bob Buckhorn is the mayor of Tampa. Tomas Regalado, the mayor of Miami, speaking with them here on Florida Public Radio. Mayor Buckhorn, what is this cleanup effort going to do to the budget for the city of Tampa? Do you have the money for it?
Well, like Mayor Regalado, we are dotting every I and crossing every T in anticipation of FEMA reimbursement. He is exactly right. Unless you follow the FEMA protocols and make sure that you have appropriate receipts for everything that you do, you will not be reimbursed. And so we are carefully making sure that we go through those processes. In the short term, there will be an impact on the budget. We don't anticipate it will be nearly as much as what Miami or Fort Myers or Naples is experiencing. And we are confident, certainly based on our conversations with FEMA and the governor's urging of FEMA to be as responsive as they can, that we will be reimbursed for the vast majority of it.
Mayor Regalado, same question to you. Do you anticipate having to find some new revenue sources?
Well, every budget year, and tomorrow we have the budget hearing, the first budget hearing. I'm in charge of the budget to go before the commission. So we place $5 million in contingency. During the year, we don't touch that. So in this case, just right at the end of the budget, we have used most of this money already. Hopefully, some will be reimbursed. However, we spend $110,000 in ICE that would not be reimbursed. We had the police in Alpha Bravo even before the storm.
Alpha Bravo is 12 hours on, 12 hours off.
12 hours on, no vacation, no right. day off. We had the firefighters. But one thing that we did, and it really cost money, but I think it worked, is that on Saturday we told Public Works and Solid Waste personnel to also be on Alpha Bravo on 12 hours. And we moved them to live on several fire stations throughout the city. So after the storm, they were able to go out yeah. in different direction with bobcats and clear the street for emergency vehicles and also for FPL trucks.
Mayor Buckhorn, what about support from the state, from state agencies? What's your experience there?
You know, it's interesting. I could not be more complimentary of Governor Scott and how aggressive he was in delivering the message that, first and foremost, that it, when mayors like Mayor Regalado and I said to evacuate, it was time to evacuate. And he also was very successful in corralling both utility companies and the fuel providers to make sure that they were able to move as successfully as possible. Now, every plan has its flaws, and you only find out these things in the midst of the proverbial fog of war. But I think for the most part, in my experience, it was a relatively seamless exercise. I mean, the state, the local governments, the federal government, particularly with FEMA, were all working on the same page. There was no drama. Everyone knew what their lane was and what their job was, and we all went out and executed it. But, you know, Governor Scott really deserves a significant amount of credit for being so message disciplined.
Bob Buckhorn is the mayor at the city of Tampa. He's with us from our member station, WUSF in Tampa. Tomas Regalado is the mayor of the city of Miami with us here from our studios in Miami. Our coverage of after Hurricane Irma will continue. Preparation and resiliency in these two major cities in Florida next. This is After Hurricane Irma from Florida Public Radio. From Florida Public Radio and WLRN in Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. This is After Hurricane Irma, a special news program from your Florida Public Radio station. Thanks for listening. We're speaking with Tampa Mayor Bob Buckhorn from our sister station WUSF in Tampa. Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado is with us from our studios here in Miami. Gentlemen, both of your cities are consistently ranked in the top five as the major metropolitan areas in the entire nation most at risk of any number of weather dangers, specifically storm surge. CoreLogic study ranked Miami number one at risk and Tampa number three at risk. Mayor Regalado, you will be asking the city of Miami voters to okay $400 million in new borrowing, half of which will go to address flooding risk. What will happen if that money is okayed, and what will happen if voters turn it down?
Well, I can't think a reason, Tom, why voters of the city of Miami will not agree to that for several reasons. Number one, this bond issue will not raise property taxes because we have the capacity. The city of Miami has been able to come back from almost bankruptcy, and we have the capacity of issue exactly around $400 million without increasing debt in property taxes.
About half of that's going to stormwater right. and flood control.
Sea level rise, flooding, and resiliency. And basically what we are trying to do with that is to get guidance. First of all, we got $1 million from the state, and I want to thank Governor Scott because he promised me he would not veto that. We got $1 million to do a new sewer master plan with sea level rise included.
That's just for the planning, though.
That's not just for the planning.
Building.
That's just $1 million for that. Because you know there are neighborhoods in the city of Miami that we have seen with the king tide in the last 3 years, completely flooded. Bellmead, Sharkcrest, and we have 11 pumps, so we need more.
These are neighborhoods in the city of Miami, but half of this bond measure you want to spend on new pumps, new resiliency. But this CoreLogic study found about $100 billion in reconstruction costs are at risk because of storm surge in Miami.
Absolutely.
Seems like just a drop in the bucket in terms of this municipal spending.
Absolutely. And what this means is that if the voters approve about $200 million, then we can go to the state. Then we can go to Washington if they listen and say, you know, we have something. I mean, we have come to the table. However, we have to understand that if we don't get anything from the state or from the federal government, we have to start doing. It will be the next mayors, the next commission, and they're going to have to do more things.
And you say that because you're term limited out of your office after serving your terms. If voters don't approve this new spending in November for the city of Miami for resiliency, will you still be a resident?
You know, I got to think about it. I mean, if the people of Miami, after Harvey, after Irma, doesn't understand that we need to do something and now, and that climate change is a reality, it's not fake news. Listen, I don't know where to move, but I got to find a place because I see every day what is happening in the city of Miami. That's why we call this bond issue Miami Forever.
I'm not sure if Tampa would provide any solace to you, Mayor Buckhorn. Maybe you've got a new resident in case Miami voters don't like this idea of new borrowing.
Well, I love Bob.
Mayor Buckhorn, what about Tampa? What about your ability, your willingness to borrow money or, for that matter, find money within the budget?
Well, first of all, I'm termed out in April of 19 as well. Maybe Tomas and I, you can retire up here, Tomas, and you and I will hang out at the West Tampa Sandwich Shop. With Maito.
Yes, and a Cuban sandwich with salami.
Don't start this one.
But Mayor Buckhorn, Mayor Regalado is looking to borrow $400 million on the city's credit and the taxpayers' credit. Should Tampa voters be expecting the same kind of thing?
Well, let me start at the beginning, and Mayor Regalado has been relentless about this. For the state government or the federal government to not acknowledge that the climate is changing and the impacts of climate change on infrastructure, particularly low-lying cities, is doing us all a great disservice. It's mayors that have been leading the way on this discussion. 2 years ago, we got the city council here to agree to a stormwater assessment in which all the residents are taxed a small amount that, for the first time in probably 40 years, Tom, has allowed us to start making significant improvements to our stormwater system. I mean, just by way of example, in the last year, we have removed 50,000 tons of debris from our stormwater system. That's barnacles, that's trash, that's grass and landscaping cuttings, it's stormwater debris. That allows the system to function and flow much better. It also allows us a dedicated revenue source to enhance and to create more capacity in our stormwater system. It's not the plant for us that's the problem. It's the 100-year-old pipes that we deal with, trying to deal with 2017 growth patterns.
And not only that, but also dealing with 2017 sea level levels. When those pipes were put in, those sea levels, according to the science and what we've seen in the research, were, you know, several inches lower.
They were. And if you look at what the anticipated temperature of the Gulf and the bay will be over the next 20, 30 years, you know, a 2-degree increase in Celsius allows for not only the storms to continue to feed off of that warmer Gulf air, but it will also allow sea level rise. The king tides in Miami are unique. We don't have those here in Tampa, but I can tell you unequivocally that we have seen a change in our climate here and the impacts on our day-to-day lives.
What assistance, financial or otherwise, would you like to see from the state and from the federal government, Mayor Buckhorn?
I would say two things. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Mayor Buckhorn.
Two things for us. One, an acknowledgement that climate change is real and that science is accurate. And number two, if this president is interested in assisting cities around the country, come up with an infrastructure plan that allows us to reinvest in our infrastructure and put people to work. If he were to do that, I think we could get started as mayors on rebuilding the infrastructure of this country, which largely would include the infrastructure underground that's not sexy, that you can't cut a ribbon on, but it's so vitally important to the quality of life of the people that live in America's cities.
Mayor Regalado, what would you like to see from your government partners?
Well, first of all, information. And I think that Bob is correct. I mean, I understand it's an ideological thing. I understand this is a policy matter. But, you know, somebody has to say to the mayors of the city or to the residents, more important, there is a new normal. Now, the normal was, you know, we got one or two storms. But the new normal is that we have five storms, got five, you know, in less than 1 month. The new normal is that storms move fast on water and stay put on land. The new normal is the storm surge. We have never, ever, ever seen the storm surge that we saw here in Miami. Mm-hmm. And people just say, you know, the experts just say it's atypical. So we have brilliant minds in this country. At least tell us, well, you know what? We don't want to call it climate change, but like Forrest Gump, it happens, you know, and this is a new normal. So you guys have to prepare for new normal. And, you know, this, I trust the city of Miami will decide that we should be prepared. This is about us, our children, and the children of our children. And I just hope that someone at the state level, that someone at the federal level say, well, you know what? I think that we should look into it and at least give a report to the residents of the United States that are in harm's way, like Tampa and Miami.
The contributions around climate change and the ideological debate around climate change may be happening at state capitals. It certainly is happening in the national federal capital. But at city halls, it's about adaptation. It's about resiliency.
It's about residents complaining.
Right.
It's about pumps
and
being installed.
What are they complaining about, Mayor Regalado and Mayor Buckley?
Flooding. I mean, we have 11 pumps in the city of Miami. We feel that we need at least 5 to 10 more. We're just finishing one in Brickell, which, by the way, had a typical event.
Those residents that are now complaining about flooding, should they continue to be residents in those neighborhoods, or should those neighborhoods wind up just going back into the high waters?
Tom, the government has the obligation to save those neighborhoods. To protect the investment of these people. There is no way that we can say to residents in the Upper East Side of Miami or even in Coconut Grove, we have 100,000 residents in the waterfront. We can't just say, hey, you know what? Bad luck.
Mayor Buckhorn, do you feel the same way about those barrier islands out in Tampa?
I do indeed. And this conversation is reminiscent of what they said to the folks in the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans as well. Mm. People are coming to Florida. They're going to live on the water. They want to live on the water. I think we can accommodate them with the appropriate infrastructure investments.
Such as in Tampa?
Well, I think it's improving our stormwater system. I think it's adapting some of the building codes that Miami-Dade did in the aftermath of Hurricane Andrew. I think it's again, elevating structures at the time of construction. I think there are techniques that can mitigate the impact of this, but the impact is very real. And for those of us at the local level, Tom, it's not a theoretical debate about who's to blame for climate change. Climate change is real, but for us, it's a quality of life issue. When someone's house floods in an afternoon thunderstorm in Tampa because our stormwater system is not adequate to handle that amount of water, that's our problem. But we also need assistance in terms of making significant financial investments in our infrastructure system. We don't have the capacity at the local level to handle it all ourselves.
Mayor Buckhorn, in Tampa, after this experience with Irma and the lead up to it, many identified your city as among the least prepared to deal with this kind of catastrophic threat. What are you doing differently this week and in the weeks and months ahead that are left in your term because of Irma?
Well, first of all, I would take exception to significant parts of that story that was written. But that being said, we recognize that we are a low-lying city, that we live on a shallow bay, that we have not been hit in 90 years and that our time will come up at some point. So we are working as quickly as we possibly can with the resources that we have, and it's largely focused on our stormwater system. Mm-hmm. Our ability to move that standing water out into the bay once it occurs is critical in terms of dealing with the effects of a surge. So in the short term, increasing capacity in our stormwater system, cleaning what we have currently, you know, redigging drainage ditches and retention ponds and cleaning out pipes is top of mind for our agenda moving forward.
What about seawalls and that kind of shoring up and reinforcement of the actual waterfront? Would that be useful at all? And do you have any investments planned?
To some degree, it would be. And certainly along our river where most mm-hmm. of our development is occurring, we are building to modern standards. We're putting a lot of riprap there to break up the surge, forcing buildings to be elevated above the 100-year floodplain. So, yes, but we have limited financial capacity, like any city in America, to do these major infrastructure projects.
Mayor Regalado, final minute left. How does Hurricane Irma change your planning and the planning of the city of Miami for the next one?
Actually, we were planning this bond issue for 2 years mm-hmm. now, and we know. We know that we did several things, but Tom, you know, the fact of the matter is that we need money right now and soon to start raising the seawalls. That's paramount. That's a priority. We need to build more pumps. We need to finish our storm sewer master plan with sea level rise. And sea level rise is for real in the city of Miami. So this is not fake news or anything. This is for real. So we need to adapt and we need to start planning. Hopefully, I'm telling you, hopefully the people of Miami will understand that they need to work for the future.
Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado with us from our studios here in Miami. Thank you so much, Mayor Regalado. Nice to see
you
again.
Thank
you. And Tampa Mayor Bob Buckhorn with us from our studios, from our sister station studios at WUSF in Tampa. Mayor Buckhorn, thank you for your time and your comments as well.
Thank you.
You are listening to After Hurricane Irma from WLRN Miami. This is Florida Public Radio. Hurricane Irma seemed to spare most of Florida a direct hit by the storm itself. But days without power and days of unpaid time off or maybe no work at all to go back to has cast a spotlight on the poverty in some of the most vulnerable communities, poverty that has existed long before Irma made landfall. WLRN's Nadege Green reports from Miami.
Before a hurricane, people are told to stock up on supplies, enough to last at least 3 days. Many families in Florida could not do that.
And my kids have not had nothing to eat this morning.
Mary McKenzie lives in Little Haiti with her 6 children and her husband. She says she bought groceries before the hurricane warning, things that needed refrigeration. After 4 days with no electricity, most of it has gone bad.
We just meeting ends meet. That's why when the storm came, we didn't have money to be doing all this. But now we had to dip into money we had for other bills to feed our kids every day. That's how we've been feeding our kids. You know, it's getting to the point where it's starting to break us because $50, $60 a day is a lot of money.
Her neighbor, Tamika Ellington, is also struggling. Ellington says if school was open, at least she wouldn't have to worry about her 5-year-old son getting enough food.
Well, at least he could eat at school.
Yeah, at least they could eat at school.
Now it's like more headache and more frustration.
After Hurricane Harvey hit Texas, the Houston School District opened 9 schools that served breakfast, lunch, and dinner to about 70,000 families. On Thursday, the Miami-Dade School District handed out about 30,000 ready-to-eat meals, MREs, often used by the military in combat zones. When Ellington heard police officers in her neighborhood announcing a free ice giveaway at a nearby park, she went. All over South Florida, people have been desperate for ice. Ellington wanted to be able to give her son something cold to drink. While waiting for the ice to be unpacked from the trucks, she said she feels like poor people in Miami are forgotten. Then she saw Miami Commissioner Keon Hardeman helping with the ice.
This has always been a place where people are living meal to meal, month to month, you know, just trying to get by.
He says the ice and food giveaways help, but can't fix the underlying long-term issue, poverty.
Miami is a place of the have and the have-nots. So you have a number of individuals that do have the ability to buy food, supplies, canned goods, etc. And then you have a great number of people who do not have that ability. You know, we just have to do better so that people can live better within our communities.
Rufus James was walking around Liberty City looking for small jobs after Hurricane Irma.
Well, I be cutting yard, I'm saying.
He normally mows lawns, but he's gotten no work since the hurricane. He has three grandchildren at home he needs to feed, and he's been without power for 4 days.
Well, I'm looking for some food, you know. We don't have no food.
Thomasina Smith also lives in Liberty City. Her daughter and three grandsons live with her.
We don't have no power. We don't even have any food anymore, but just snacks and stuff for the kids and stuff. Today will be the first day without food. Yeah, today will be the first day.
She says the small neighborhood stores in walking distance to her home are bare. And even when they're not, many are only accepting cash because the power's out. So people with electronic benefit food cards, commonly known as food stamps, can't swipe to buy anything. I'm Nadege Green in Miami.
Still to come in our program, getting the power turned back on. About 4% of Florida remained without power as of 6 o'clock this morning, 8 days after Hurricane Irma first came ashore in the Florida Keys. You are listening to special coverage from Florida Public Radio after Hurricane Irma from WLRN Miami and Florida Public Radio. From WLRN Public Media in Miami and Florida Public Radio, this is After Hurricane Irma. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. 1 week ago, more than 6.5 million Florida electric customers were without power. About 500,000 or so remain. While Irma was a Category 4 storm when it first made landfall in the Keys, wind gusts across most of Florida did not top Category 1 hurricane strength, according to the National Weather Service. Yet the storm put almost 90% of Florida Power and Light customers in the dark. FPL is the largest electric utility in the state. Three-quarters of Duke Energy's Florida customers also lost power. The repair work continues on this Monday, and the investigations into why these power systems couldn't withstand Irma likely will get underway in the days and weeks ahead. J.R. Kelly joins us now from his office in Tallahassee. He is the Public Counsel of Florida, where he represents utility customers to state and federal regulators. Mr. Kelly, thank you for joining Florida Public Radio today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
How do you judge the response from the public utilities to the damage left by Irma?
Well, it's hard at this point to give a full judgment because it'll depend on the review of all the costs and the actions taken by the utilities that certainly will not take place until months after these events. For example, when Hurricane Matthew hit last year, we still have not had the filing from Florida Power and Light to be able to look at the full magnitude of those costs and how the utility reacted. So this is a bigger storm, and we just don't know at this point when they will make their petition.
You're very cautious there, waiting for the report and some documentation from the power companies, from FPL, but also Duke Energy is involved with this. All 67 counties of Florida experienced some effect from Irma, and much of the service territory from FPL, all the service territory from FPL was affected, and also Duke Energy. But what's your sense of the response, what you're hearing in the media coverage, what you're experiencing maybe personally or professionally with colleagues around the state?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's been a little disappointing to hear in the news that with all the new smart grid enhancements that cost customers billions of dollars over the past few years, that when they're calling up a utility and the utility reports that their power's back on, and lo and behold, they get back to their house and they have no power, they call the utility a second time and they say, oh, our smart grid's telling us your power's on, and they have no power. That's a little disappointing because the companies have spent billions of dollars in upgrading and enhancing their smart grid. Mm-hmm. So that's something certainly we're going to take a close look at in the months to come.
$3 billion, in fact, has been spent by Florida Power and Light alone since Hurricane Wilma in 2005 really decimated its power grid. Although there has been caution voiced by some within the community that those upgrades really have been directed at picking up the pace of repairing the system as opposed to preventing outages. Have we seen that in exercise here because of Hurricane Irma?
Well, I think that there's probably has been some of the enhancements made did prevent additional damage that could have been done. For example, I know that there was a replacement of a lot of the light poles with concrete poles, right. And the reports I have heard is the concrete poles are still standing, and the loss of the wooden poles was kept to a minimum this time, as compared to when you go back to the hurricane season of 2004-2005. You know, the one thing that unfortunately you can't prevent is the debris that flies during a hurricane, and if it knocks lines down, even though a pole may be still standing, if a line's down, it's not doing you any good. Another thing is I know a lot of people are calling for undergrounding of utilities. Mm-hmm. That in and of itself is not going to necessarily reduce outages to a total minimum. For example, here in Tallahassee, I have underground utilities in my neighborhood, and we lost power for 12 hours. Why? Because one of the power lines that comes into the neighborhood, one of the transformers got hit by a fallen tree, and therefore my power was out. So undergrounding can be a double-edged sword.
J.R. Kelly is the public counsel of Florida. He represents utility customers to state and federal regulators. And to this point about debris-caused line outages, overhead line outages. Let's listen to Florida Power and Light Vice President of Communications Rob Gould speaking to the media on Friday.
We're seeing quite a bit of these trees that have come into our lines, and that has been a challenge for us. Now, the good news from an infrastructure perspective is we've not seen the pole damage that we had seen previously in, say, Hurricane Wilma back in 2005. None of our poles have come down as a result of wind into the poles themselves.
So the poles were able to withstand the wind. Some of those older poles maybe not be able to withstand big branches, trees, and palm fronds. This brings up the situation around tree trimming. J.R. Kelly is public counsel of Florida. It seems really just basic maintenance as we look around the vegetation-rich neighborhoods throughout South Florida. Who's responsible for tree trimming around these power lines?
It is the direct responsibility of the utilities. They're required annually to come in front of the Public Service Commission, which is the regulatory agency for the investor-owned utilities, such as Florida Power and Light and Duke and Tampa Electric. And they must report what their annual plans are for storm hardening. And that certainly includes tree trimming, vegetation trimming, or in some cases, completely taking out the vegetation, mm-hmm. depending on where you're at and what the growth is.
I got to think this is going to be a focus and a line of questioning around tree trimming investments on the part of FPNL and Duke Energy, the biggest electric providers in the state, and evidence of that kind of spending and where they're spending it, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, that's going to be first and foremost we want, you know, to the best of our ability, we want to make sure that the money that's spent, and make no mistake, this is customer money that's being spent,
right.
Is being spent prudently and reasonably to ensure that those activities did in fact take place. And if they didn't, then certainly why they did not.
We're speaking with J.R. Kelly, the public counsel of Florida. He represents utility customers to state and federal regulators, most notably the Florida Public Service Commission, which is the group that oversees electric utility. And we did invite the chairman of the PSC, Julie Brown, to participate in our conversation. She sent us an emailed statement that read in part, quote, "While it may seem appropriate a week after the storm, but through recovering, for the chair of the Florida Public Service Commission to participate in media interviews and express comments on the quality of responsiveness of regulated utilities and to opine on the capabilities of utilities to respond to storms. One of the key statutory responsibilities of the chair is to preside over legal evidentiary proceedings whereby utilities come before the commission, file legal documents, and seek cost recovery associated with storm events." And then the chairwoman continued that the Public Service Commission must sit in judgment of the matter, review all evidence presented from the parties, and render a decision in the matter which best serves the interest of the public. The law expressly prohibits a commissioner from commenting on any matter that will foreseeably come before the commission. So they did not accept our invitation to discuss some of this today. J.R. Kelly did, as the public counsel of Florida. Let's talk about paying for this restoration. FPL customers, for instance, are still paying for the restoration from Hurricane Matthew, which, as you mentioned, was a much smaller storm and impacted a much smaller area of FPL's service area. What do you anticipate seeing from the electric companies, FPL, Duke, and others, as they look to help pay for the restoration efforts?
Well, so far as how much the cost is going to be, I have no idea, but I will be very surprised if we're not looking near $1 billion collectively for all of the utilities.
Let's give a little bit of scale, JR, if you can, about $1 billion restoration effort, if that is in fact a price tag that's close for Irma.
Well, it depends on the utility, but I'll give you an example. Hurricane Matthew, Florida Power and Light first estimated that the damages for there were approximately $318 million, and that was came out to be about $3.10, somewhere in that neighborhood, mm-hmm. per 1,000 kilowatt hours per month for a residential customer.
Which FPL customers are still paying today. That's a 12-month surcharge.
Yes, sir. And so they'll be paying it for a few months more. And as I mentioned earlier, Florida Power & Light still has not filed their final accounting for Matthew. So therefore, we have not had an opportunity to vet those numbers and dig down to see if those are their actual costs. Once the actual cost is confirmed and approved by the commission, then there could be a refund or an additional surcharge added to that $3.10 or so surcharge. About the time that the Matthew surcharge will come off the bill, I would anticipate a new surcharge being placed there for Irma. And if
and that could be the case for Duke Energy customers as well as other electric customers in the state of Florida. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. They will all file. They will be able to put a surcharge on, and it's a interim surcharge, if you will, because it'll go for approximately a year, and then once the final accounting is filed, and we have a chance to vet it, review it, analyze it, and then the final amount is confirmed by the commission, mm-hmm. they will then be a true-up after that to the consumer.
Has there ever been an instance of a true-down? In other words, the surcharge was actually higher than what the actual repair and restoration costs turned out to be?
There have definitely been true-downs, if you will, for certain charges in the past. Whether there's actually been one for a storm mm-hmm. surcharge, I don't know. The okay. last time that the real storm surcharges were...
real quick, Mr. Kelly.
I'm sorry, were in place were in 2004, 2005, and they were quite large
yeah.
at that time.
Those were the big storm years. J.R. Kelly, yeah. we've got to keep it there. Public counsel for the state of Florida. He represents utility customers to state and federal regulators, joining us from Tallahassee. You are listening to After Hurricane Irma from WLRN Miami. This is Florida Public Radio. Finally, this storm will be remembered by anyone and everyone in its path, even for the most hardened hurricane veterans. Larry Kahn is the editor of the Keynoter newspaper serving the Florida Keys. He did not evacuate, a decision he came to regret. We spoke with him before, during, and after Irma.
Saturday, September 9th, 12:34 p.m. The eye of Hurricane Irma is 170 miles southeast of Key West.
I'm stuck here in Marathon, Florida, middle Florida Keys, between Key West and Key Largo. And a lot of people have been saying, why didn't you get out when they told you to get out? Well, it's because the storm kept changing. But I shouldn't have stayed this long. I'll be honest. I should have left. On my street, our canal that heads out to the Atlantic, I see the water already rising. I'm not real encouraged that I'm going to have a place to come back to. My car? Who knows? So, it is what it is. You know, I've been living here 23 years. Been through a lot of hurricanes. This one, everyone took seriously.
Sunday, September 10th, 12:31 a.m. The eye of Hurricane Irma is 80 miles south-southeast of Key West.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm here at Marathon High School, which is halfway between Key West and Key Largo, and there's only about 50 people here at the shelter. It's actually called the Refuge of Last Resort. But we have the county sheriff here and all of the lieutenants. They're here, so I feel like I'm the safest guy in the world right now. I got a good bunkie next to me, a guy named Cowboy, who I've gotten to know all day. I'm hearing around the building the bathrooms have failed. Outside, it's bad. It's really bad outside. I don't know, numerous hours ago, the goalposts on the football field, they were down. But I will tell you, we've been having power issues here. You know, sometimes the lights will all go flashing at once, and then they'll all go dark. But, you know, I got to say, everyone's been really respectful. Hell, I think we got like 50 animals. People in the classroom over there where they got, I think, 3 dogs and 5 cats. Remarkably, what I haven't seen, we don't have any children here. I've been living down here 23 years. I've never evacuated. I've never left my house. And I got really confused. I didn't know what to take. I mean, at one point, and I'm not kidding, I put a screwdriver because I didn't know what to do. And so I was like, why am I taking a screwdriver? You know? What I would really love right now is to find my earbuds because I thought I threw them in my bag and apparently I didn't. We're not in the worst of it yet. Worst of it's going to hit in the morning.
Friday, September 15th, 1:10 p.m. The eye of Hurricane Irma made landfall 5 days ago.
People woke up. Some thought that the worst of the hurricane had hit. But then, of course, you know, the winds were still kicking up. And then we started seeing a little bit of a storm surge. It never got nearly as high as they said it would. Although the rental car I had did start to float away for a little while. And remarkably, it started later in the afternoon. But that Sunday morning, it was very, very windy. But everybody wants to see the storm surge. At this point, people weren't getting antsy to get out yet. I was staying in the common area, and a guy walked out. Turns out it was a guy I hadn't seen in like 4 years. And he said, you know, I'm thinking of walking home. You know, do you want to go with me? And so I was just dilly-dallying, you know, and I was like, but I don't want to spend another night shelter. It's really dark in there. It's quiet. So I packed up my computer, my bag, my blanket, and we jumped in my rental car, and we drove the quarter mile down to his house. We get there, and we walk in. He had about 5 inches of rain on the floor, maybe a little bit more come in on the roof. But overall, really, really good shape. So I stayed at his house. You know, again, no electricity, no sewer, no any of that. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And I got to tell you, I was in a lot better situation than anybody else. We ate steaks. We ate chicken breasts. We ate chicken tenders. We ate bacon for breakfast. We ate nachos. He had a stocked bar. We didn't abuse that by any stretch. We just had one cocktail a day. And we spent hours and hours and hours and hours catching up, talking, because there was nothing else to do. So now it's Wednesday morning. My family hadn't heard from me since Saturday morning. Nobody had an idea where I was. In hindsight, strictly the hurricane, I would go. You got to make the decision and you got to be decisive. I wasn't decisive this time. I'm a poor example for people doing the hurricane planning. I'm the first to admit that. You know, everybody's got to make their own individual choice. Myself, this time, I would have made a different choice.
Larry Kahn, editor of The Keynoter. He weathered Hurricane Irma in the Middle Keys. You've been listening to After Hurricane Irma on Florida Public Radio. It is produced by WLRN Public Media in Miami. We received production help this hour from our sister station WUSF in Tampa. Reporting for this program came from WGCU in Fort Myers, WMFE in Orlando, WUSF in Tampa, WQCS Fort Pierce, and WJCT in Jacksonville. Our thanks to all of our Florida Public Radio sister stations. Alicia Zuckerman, Terrence Shepard, Gina Jordan, Wilson Sayre, Sammy Mack, they all helped with editing and producing. Pilar Ribe is our technical director with engineering help from Doug Peterson. John Labonia is the general manager of WLRN Public Media, and I'm Tom Hudson. This special program from Florida Public Radio has been a presentation of WLRN Public Media in Miami.
Podcasts on WLRN are funded in part by Make-A-Wish Southern Florida, whose own podcast, World of Wishes, features inspiring, uplifting, and memorable stories from wish kids, their families, medical professionals, and more. You can listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.